think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
So they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors. Or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 288 of Low Limit Football on this 28th of June, 2020. I am your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight you are getting your show one day early so that Rob and I can take tomorrow off and I can wish my wife a very happy birthday. Germany's 19-2020 season is over. Bayern are champions. Lewandowski, the top goal scorer, and Timo Werner makes his farewell to Leipzig very, very special as he leaves for Chelsea. Liverpool are champions of the EPL for the first time, equaling Blackburn and Leicester's title tally. They are the first team in EPL history to hold the EPL title, the Champions League title, the UEFA Super Cup title, and the Club World Cup title all at the same time. We're going to look at the remaining league races in Italy and Spain. Did Lazio drop points on their difficult return to Serie A? Would Juve continue to pick up form? And in Spain, who will blink now that Barca and Real began the weekend even on points? We're going to discuss that and much, much more with our very special guest from BN Sports and Inter Miami, broadcaster Andres Cordero, who will join us in just a little bit. But first, Mr. Roberto Rojas, do you have something enlightening to ask me this week?
No, I don't actually, but I will say this. You did see the debut of Luca Romero, the kid from Mallorca, right?
No, I missed it.
But you know who it is, right? I think you must have heard of it, or no?
No.
So history was made back on the 24th.
Okay.
So 4 days ago. Luca Romero, an Argentine-born Mexican? I don't know what it's... It's a weird one. This is like one of the more weird nationalities. So Luca Romero made his debut for Mallorca against Real Madrid a couple days ago.
Okay.
He becoming the youngest player ever to feature in a La Liga match at 15 years, 7 months, and 6 days.
Wow.
He was born in Mexico, but he was raised... He has Argentine parents, but he moved to Spain when he was 3. So... It's now a mix of this guy figuring out where he's going to play for. But when you get the chance, I don't want you to just look at the videos. Okay. Look at his hair.
Oh, okay. All right. I've got to go check this out then. I've been scanning the boards all weekend, and this one I definitely missed. So I'm going to definitely look that up and check out his hair at least. Just curious. I mean, obviously a 15-year-old, you know, getting into a match in La Liga of all places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about Ansu Fati, Ricky Puig, who we've seen come up lately. Where's this kid's nationality? Is he linked to Mexico or is he linked to Argentina? Do we know?
Nobody knows. The only thing that we do know is that he represented Argentina at youth level.
Okay.
But everyone's saying that he's the Mexican Messi, you know, that kind of thing, or the next Messi. But it's like, it's weird because he could literally represent 3 national teams because of the place that he was born in, his parents, and where he grew up since the age of 3. So, wow. Yeah, I guess we got to gotta watch out for this guy. Maybe we're gonna see a future talent. I mean, to be fair, Joe, I mean, I think now we're kind of in an era where there are so many youth players coming up. I mean, you talk about your Atsu Fati, you talk about your Ricky Pugh over there, and obviously that's gonna be, I think he's going to be a big name to watch out for, given our opening thoughts that we're going to talk about.
Exactly. You know, let's get into it in a minute. And then also afterwards, after we come back from our interview, we're going to have another young talent, I think, that we're going to talk about as well. So a lot of youth in this show today, I guess we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
Let Definitely. Me give you the trivia question for today. And this is a real easy one, Rob, because, you know, it's just something I worked up. But obviously front and center on many people's minds, aside from the races that we're seeing in Europe as these leagues get fired back up and they're moving along, is the big transfer news that came out this week with Miralem Pjanic going to Barcelona, Arthur Melo coming back to Juve, and I believe $10 million also going with Pjanic over. There is a thread on Twitter that now I cannot find, Rob, and I'm hoping you can find it quick, that really explains amortizing this money and why this transfer happened like this. And you know, we're going to talk about the transfer a little more in opening thoughts, but David Amoyal even tweeted within the past day that this is the way these transfers are going to look this week. So I wanted to give you an Arthur Pjanic type question. So very simple. Pjanic is 30 years old. Arthur is 22, I believe. And between 23. And between the two of them, they have played for six different teams. I'm not counting Barca for Arthur. I'm not counting Barca for Pjanic. I'm not counting Juve for Arthur. So Arthur currently has played for two teams, and Pjanic has played for four teams in their careers. Can you name the six teams? And you obviously know two of them because you have Juve and Barca right off the bat. So you had to give me four more teams. But can you give me the six teams that these two have played at one point in their careers?
I know Arthur's off the top of my head.
Arthur's easy, but the Pjanic one's going to be a little tougher. So
yeah, that one I'll have to think about it.
We'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So let's hit opening thoughts. And again, we're going to stick with the theme. We're going to stick with the Arthur transfer with, you know, Miralem Pjanic. This happened actually up to the minute they have completed their physicals. And right now, it's just really mattering an announcement. At the beginning of the week, last week, when we first started to talk about this, we were in a situation where Arthur had not agreed to go to Juve. At that point, Pjanic had agreed to go to Barca, but the flip around was not happening as of yet. So now we have agreement. We've had physicals. Arthur, after the Barca game yesterday, flew into Turin. They did all their physicals in Turin, and I think right now the world is just waiting for an announcement. There is a great thread on this from someone called the Swiss Ramble, and it's at Swiss Ramble. Look it up on Twitter. That explains how this happens, why Arthur is going to, on paper, why Arthur is going to Juve for $80 million and Pjanic is going for $70 million back. I know it's a plus 10 for Barca, but why these particular numbers? It's a great explanation about amortizing their value and really clearing up the financial fair play. Many have gone on Twitter and called it money laundering, and I can't say that I disagree. But unfortunately, with the rules of financial fair play, this is what's going to happen. So we can talk about the transfer part of it, the math part of it, in a minute, Rob. But obviously, when you look at this move, this is really a win for Juve, in my opinion. They're going to get 7 years younger in a kid that is really a budding star. He's getting time at Barca in that midfield that's clogged. Frankie de Jong, Sergio Busquets. You know, you've got so many other talented, you know, Ivan Rakitic. There's so many players in that midfield, and he's getting time in there. He's going to come into this Juve midfield, a midfield that I've been complaining about that has been too slow. And it's something that they haven't corrected. They made the flashy move for Ronaldo. They never corrected the speed of the midfield, and they've been exposed for it. Now you bring him in. I think this is a massive move for Juve. For me, and I think for many Barca fans, it's still a head-scratcher as to why you're bringing in Miralem Pjanic. But Pjanic does offer his own qualities that he can bring to Barca. He's metronomic in a way. He is steady on the ball. Obviously, he's a little slower foot, and he's on the 30-year-old side of the playing career. So I want your thoughts on both players, the move, you know, what you think of all of it.
Well, I think it's really kind of weird to see how such a move like this could happen in the first place. As I've said beforehand, I said this last week, you know, I don't see anything else besides, you know, obviously a financial standpoint coming good out of this. No disrespect to Pjanic as well, but if you really want to build for your future, you cannot deal with someone that is 30 years old. I get that he has the experience and everything, but he's fallen off. He has been falling off for quite some time, or at least for a few months. He's not the same player that he was. Now, with Arthur, you could still correct those mistakes because he's still a young player. Like I said, he's only 23. You want to build for that future when you have the likes of a Frankie de Jong, a Ricky Pugh, an Ansu Fati up front, you know, that kind of post-Messi era that you're looking at. It kind of has to work that way. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think Barcelona are just more focused on the financial standpoint because they know they need to balance the books of all the costs that they've done. And we spoke with this with Drake Cordero last week about it. So, again, I don't think there really is much to say besides that, Joe. I mean, I think Juventus have won the lottery with this. Mm-hmm. You know, they're getting a young, good player that is going to help that midfield so much. I think with Arthur, you know, Juventus are finally taking a step in that midfield department with a player that could really elevate them in the area that they're lacking the most. And having him and Bentancur, I think that's a really solid creative duo to build around.
No doubt about it. And again, like I'd said, they've both completed their medicals at Juventus Medical. Barca wanted the medicals all completed in one spot. The gist of the move is that it will be announced and the players will remain in at their current respective clubs until the end of the season. For me, this is the interesting part. We have a very concerning situation here. We're starting to see players fall for injury. We're going to see a lot of wear and tear on these players' bodies, and it is, you know, where Arthur really is kind of shuffled into the mix at Barca. Pjanic is really more of a mainstay in that midfield at Juve. So it's going to be interesting to see, hopefully, neither of them get hurt, right? I think that's first and foremost, Rob, is that neither of these players get hurt as they move through and navigate the rest of their seasons. And both teams are still in the Champions League. So I kind of joked to you yesterday, wouldn't it be funny if we had a Juve-Barca final? Who do these guys play for? Do they play, you know, I mean, I know by rule they're supposed, you know, Pjanic is supposed to play for Juve, Arthur's supposed to play for Barca, but let me ask you this. Could there be an agreement where neither player plays in a Champions League final if the two teams would get there?
Most likely. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely up there, but that's in the biggest hypotheticals of hypotheticals. Sure. So, we'll see. I guess we'll have to. I guess it's up to the clubs and obviously UEFA have to have some sort of understanding towards it when a particular situation like this happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if it does make it to that. And you know, for you and I as fans, I think we would both welcome a Juve Barca final for sure. One just for the drama of the match, the drama of the Ronaldo Messi tie, the drama of what do you do with Pjanic and Arthur? I mean, there's so many stories that could happen if they do get to that final in the Champions League. We'd be drooling about it for weeks. So, you know, just to touch back on the Swiss Ramble tweet that he put out, and again, go out and find this. This is great, great stuff. Arthur was purchased by Barcelona in 2018 for $30 million on a six-year contract. So they've amortized that down, and his contract value is $20 million. And I'm just looking right now quickly for the Pjanic information. The Pjanic information is, let's see here. Pjanic was purchased in 2016 for $35 million. That's amortized down, I want to say, to $21 million his value. So the difference is about 13 million euros between the two players in terms of amortized contracts and movement, and hence Juve sending 10 extra million to Barca for them. But to make the numbers match, the transfers are labeled at 80 and 70 million respectively, and then the 10 million goes over. So huge move coming up, obviously, right off the bat. Two of the biggest clubs in the world making a big splash before an ambiguous transfer window is open, and it's going to be interesting to see how this is managed along
both by players and teams. But then as we get in, you know, the money, I'm sure Financial Fair Play is going to put their eyes on this and see what they're we're going to say. So, and then what other sales may come from these two teams to kind of balance the books as we move on in these very, very strange times. Right now, I think we can announce that we are hoping to have David Amoyal from Gianluca DiMarzio and the Calcio Land podcast on with us on our next show, where we're going to get to dig deeper into the transfer window, some of the new transfer rules, and some of the things that he may see coming up. We're hoping to have that set up and then bring that to you on our next show. So let's close our opening thoughts, Rob, at this point, and bring on Drake Cordero. Andres Cordero from BN Sports and broadcaster for Inter Miami was gracious enough earlier in the week to give us some time where we could talk about Spain, the La Liga title race, and many of the other things that are going on both there and with the tournament, the MLS tournament coming up in Orlando in just a little over a week's time. So without further ado, the Drake Cordero interview. And joining us now on Low Limit Football from BN Sports and Inter Miami, it's Andres Cordero. Dre, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you back. I want to open the questions with you in terms of much has been made over the past week about a possible transfer of Arthur going from Barcelona to Juve, and then in return, Miralem Pjanic and some money going back to Barcelona. I don't want to ask you so much about the transfer, but given the fact that Pjanic is 29 years old, he's been on the scene for a while. You know, he came on the scene at Roma, really flourished at Juve, but in a little bit of a decline. Arthur is a little bit of a, I would say, less known product because he's really just been on the scene. He's 23 years old, so he's much younger. So from your perspective covering La Liga, I'd like to know your opinion and your impressions of Arthur the player.
Oh, well, first of all, thanks for the invite. It's been a while since we chatted, and happy to be back. I think Arthur is actually one of the really good, smart buys that Barcelona have made in recent seasons, where they haven't really made a ton of those. They've tended to sort of overpay for players. And Arthur, given his salary at Barcelona, given that he was already a South American champion with Gremio when he came over, was the player who really just seemed to fit the Barcelona DNA, the way that they wanted to play, the characteristics that they want out of a central midfielder. I also think that you know, the same is true for Maurizio Sarri at Juve. I think he would love to have a player like Arthur, who I think could be maybe, if you remember how Sarri used Alan at Napoli, I think Arthur is probably a better version of that, potentially. Again, young player, I think he's only 23 years old still. But again, South American champion, has proven that he could play at the level of La Liga for a club like Barcelona, that the shirt doesn't weigh heavy on him. So it's a little surprising that Barcelona seem to want to move him, only from a sporting perspective. But I don't think that the Arthur move, if it does go forward, really is about sporting merit with Barcelona, and probably much more about finances.
And I think that's obviously been the key situation that's been going on, you know, is trying to balance those books, as we know how Barcelona have been able to overspend and how they're trying to get them back. I mean, you know, we don't know if this is going to happen or not, but just, you know, you look at how this team is trying to build for the, you know, the so-called post-Messi future. You know, you have the likes of Arthur, you have the likes of a Frankie de Jong, who is around the same age. You know, you have other players like Ansu Fati coming up, or Ricky Pugh as well. I mean, you know, do you feel that maybe Barcelona will regret this move in the end? Or like you said, is this just more focusing it on a financial standpoint?
You know, it's difficult to talk about because, again, I don't think it's really a sporting decision, especially when you consider how Pjanic has seemed to struggle at Juve this season in particular. And so I suspect that it has more to do with balancing books ahead of the 2021 presidential election for Barcelona. I know that this particular board, if you trace it back to when Sandro Rosell was in charge and Josep Bartomeu, the current president, was sort of his vice president and right-hand man, or further back to when they were both part of John Laporta's board, it's not the first time that they've sort of applied creative accounting practices. Right? So it doesn't really tie into football, I think, in the way that we'd like to talk about it. It's probably much more to do with the, I think, the less fun sort of nuts and bolts of how you make the numbers work in a climate of financial fair play. And I do think it has probably something to do with the need to still revitalize the squad somehow, and so find ways little by little, and I don't think Arthur will get you the whole way there, to be able to finance, whether it's a Lautaro Martinez or whatever other sort of squad renovations are needed in the next transfer window. So I just, to put it simply, from a purely sporting standpoint, it makes absolutely no sense to me that you would swap Artur for Miral Ilicic. And Artur, again, given his age, given that Barcelona's financial issues aren't just, I mean, as far as I know them, I'm not a financial expert, right? But they're not just with transfer fees and with the impact of the pandemic and sort of offsetting some of the hit that they'll take, but also in terms of their salaries, because it was a very short while ago that Barcelona became the first club in history to average 10 million euro in salary per year per player. And Artur at Barcelona, given the reported numbers, is well below that. So it doesn't even make sense in terms of shedding salary, because Pjanic, I believe, is making more at Juve than Artur is at Barcelona. So again, if we just focus on the sporting thing, it doesn't make much sense.
I think I agree as well. And it's it'll be interesting to see what happens here. And I think what's even more important now, and I think now scheduling into the race that we're seeing in La Liga, you know, obviously we saw Barcelona win, meeting Athletic Club as on this day that we're recording. Obviously, both teams are really, them and Real Madrid are still neck and neck for this race. And I personally think that this race will definitely go all the way to the end. But having said that, Dre, I mean, what I think this will be an important factor in this entire race is kind of the idea of the depth that you have. As you know, they're using the new sub rule that will allow more players to play, but also just how they are able to rotate properly. As we saw with Real Madrid, you know, they're able to rotate properly and get a good win, beating Sociedad over there. And then you look at Barcelona, who, you know, of course are doing their rotations as well, but also are dealing with some injuries. So, you know, looking forward into, as we get into the tail end of the season, you know, is that deciding factor for this title race? It's just the depth and also just the way that both Zinedine Zidane and Quique Setién are able to rotate their players.
So before getting into that, if I could just talk about the five sub rule, this might be sort of wildly unpopular, but I genuinely like the five substitution rule. And I get that it's sort of an emergency enactment based on the condensed schedules and that they're sort of sprint marathoning to the finish line here, and that it does put an incredible, you know, burden on players' fitness and their legs. And I think maybe we'll see more injuries. And so I get why they put it in an emergency situation. But just more broadly, how many years have we been talking about the overall footballing calendar being just too condensed, too many international matches, too much football on the legs of players at the elite level when you're, for example, a top Premier League club or a top French club and you're playing in two domestic cup competitions as well as your league, as well as your European competition, and just how difficult it is for players to then go on a short break and then go and play, you know, national team competitions in the summer and then go back after another short break. I actually think that this is potentially a good way of dealing with that, and more so when you still hear from FIFA the idea of expanding the Club World Cup to be more like an actual World Cup that has more teams in it. And so I don't know if once this, you know, genie's been out of the bottle that you can necessarily put it back in. Maybe you can, maybe it's just not going to be, you know, popular enough to make it permanent, but I actually don't mind it. And I think it gives managers some tactical flexibility when you can essentially swap out half of your field players. The traditionalists will hate it. I think people resist change no matter what. But I genuinely do not hate this five substitute thing, and I think it adds an interesting element to football. That aside, you would think that just given the current climate of, you know, playing in La Liga a minimum of 72 hours apart, the teams that are deeper, that can variate the most from their starting 11, that are younger, that, you know, players don't take quite as long to recover from a game, will benefit from this sort of format. And so Real Madrid are probably younger, probably deeper, actually factually younger and probably deeper than Barcelona are. And so, yeah, I would see them having a little bit of an advantage. But that was probably true in some capacity even before pre-pandemic, in that I believe Real Madrid and Valencia are the only two of the only teams that have not repeated a starting 11 all season long. So Zidane has rotated in some capacity, has rotated every single match in La Liga without repeating a starting 11. And so that probably is, you know, amplified by now having to play every 3 days or so, probably more equipped Real Madrid to deviate from whatever their quote-unquote Gala 11 is than Barcelona are.
You know, Dre, I just want to jump in for a second because going back to your point about the five sub rule, which I also do like as well, especially when you're given the added schedule, then the international breaks when these players are going to play for their national teams and the different cup competitions and the Champions League and Europa League and so on and so forth. There's so much football that wears and tears on these players that they really don't get a break. This massive 3 month coronavirus break has been the biggest break they've all gotten in many, many years. But for me, the one thing that I enjoy about this break or about this rule is the fact that it allows the more cerebral managers for me to strategize a little bit more when they're making their subs to really, I think, kind of affect the game a little bit more mentally for me, because it allows some of the brighter managers to maybe make those moves that were maybe they didn't have an opportunity previously. Now they can make that move that they need and they can affect the game in the way they want to. I mean, what are your thoughts on the managerial aspect of this? Do you think it allows them to be a little more creative and affect the game a little bit more?
Yeah, I think the other day we saw the first ever, I forget what game it was, but we saw the first ever quadruple substitution, which I really thought it would be like Paco Gemes would be the first to do it, and it turned out it wasn't. Because Paco Gemes has like fame for swapping players out in the 30th minute if he doesn't like something that he's seeing. I do, like as I mentioned, I think it adds something to the strategizing of the game. It allows you to make those adjustments. I think the same is true of the cooling breaks, which are working almost as like NBA timeouts, where, you know, at the 30-minute mark and 15 minutes from full time, you sort of get to recoup. And I think we've seen how that can affect games. For example, in Barcelona Sevilla the other day, where for 30 minutes Barcelona were absolutely brilliant, looking, you know, as good as they have all season, didn't find that goal. You saw Lopetegui make some adjustments at the 30-minute mark during that cooling break, and it was sort of a different ball game for the remaining 60 minutes. I don't know that I'm as big a fan of cooling breaks when you don't need them as I am of the substitutions, but it shows you how, you know, the technical coaches do have some tools to play with when you add these little things. And I think one of the things that I really appreciate about the five substitution rule is that they had the foresight to limit it to three in-game moments, so that it couldn't just be a way to waste time down the final minutes of a game where you have five interruptions, you know, to just use the clock in a way that's almost shameless. So again, I like the way that they've implemented it. I like what it's done to the game. I have no complaints. And ultimately, the better players are still going to be needed for more minutes. So, you know, the Messis of the world, the Benzemas are still going to get a significant amount of time. It's not as if you're taking away from the quality of the game. If anything, you're adding to it because you're bringing on fresher legs in games that would sort of normally just be dying out because of tired legs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, I think now what we're seeing with these type of players, just going back to Barcelona, you know, we're getting that kind of, players are starting to get much older. And obviously the one that we do have to mention is, of course, Mr. Lionel Messi, who on this time of recording will turn 33 tomorrow. Hard to believe that. But, you know, Dre, just looking at how you assess Messi's season this season, I mean, you know, obviously we didn't see much of him because of his injury at the start, but obviously, you know, obviously regained form. He has 21 goals in the league, 26 overall. He's one goal short of getting his 700th career goal. So, I mean, obviously we could still see that kind of level of genius and magic that we've always been associated with Lionel Messi for many, many years. But how have you assessed Lionel Messi's season so far as he approaches 33?
I don't know that I can say much more beyond he's still, at 33 years old, for me, the best player on the planet. I mean, how many players could say that, you know, at that age? Even some of the greats of the game, but, you know, by that time, were likely passing the torch to whatever the next generation is. And you look at Messi right now, and yeah, maybe he doesn't win, you know, another golden shoe to add to his record, because you look at someone like Lewandowski with 33 Bundesliga goals, and he might take it. But Messi still top of La Liga in goals, still top of La Liga in assists, still an absolutely, you know, monumental presence for Barcelona. And you can see when he's not at his best, how much a team like Barca that are full of stars that have won virtually everything struggle. Yeah, some of that might be systematic, but I just don't know. I think we've run out of vocabulary for Lionel Messi, and he's still playing at such a high level. I think precisely because he doesn't depend as much on his physicality, on the burst of acceleration, and so much of his game is cerebral, is about picking out the passes, is about his vision, about being a facilitator when he needs to be, and a goal scorer when he needs to be, and doing both things as well as virtually any player on the planet. So at 33, I don't think, you know, yeah, maybe it's not the 90-plus goals that he scored in 2012, you know, 50 goals in La Liga, but still is, in its own way, maybe the highest level from any individual performer on the planet.
And Joe, I mean, obviously we don't want to make the comparisons to his so-called traditional rival in Cristiano Ronaldo, but, you know, even what we see over the last few months of how him, and obviously he's like 2 years older than him, he's starting to slow down despite also being a bit effective. I think when you look at someone like Lionel Messi, who, you know, as we had also mentioned, also is, you know, notching up the assist, notching up the goals, you know, is leading those categories here and being as effective as he is, you know, even at when he's approaching 33, you know, you can't say anything else besides that.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you're looking at a player that you know, at 33 years old, you would expect most players to start to slow down. And I think we've probably seen it a little bit in Lionel Messi, but this is a person that is slowed down to the tune of leading La Liga in goals, leading La Liga in assists. He's still the talisman. He still can't be contained. Again, like we said at the time of this recording, I'm still shocked he's on 699 goals, that he hasn't broken through. He had an opportunity at the end of the game against Athletic Club with a free kick that hit the wall. But it's just, you know, for somebody that's slowed down, he is still playing better than 99% of the players on the earth, okay? And it's just, it's a credit to the high standard that Lionel Messi has set for himself over his career, because, you know, we're talking about Lionel Messi scoring 20 goals and 15 assists, and we're like, oh yeah, you know, he slowed down a little bit. There are players in this world that would dream to have that kind of season, and he's not done, if you think about it. You know, he still has Champions League to go. He still has the rest of La Liga to go. It's just, it's a testament to the quality and to the player that he is, that, you know, we are very lucky, whether we're journalists or whether we're fans or whatever, that we've gotten to see one of the greatest of all times play and have the access to that, you know, as well. It's just something incredible. Dre,
no, if I could add, Joe, before you please. Move on from that, it's just, you know, forget for a moment the sort of cumulative stats of like how many goals he scores this season, or, you know, how many key passes he has, or, you know, how many assists or whatnot, like whatever metrics you want to put to it. One of the things that's just astonishing to me about Messi is that for virtually, you know, basically a little over a decade and a half now, he still manages to show you things in games that you've never seen before. Right? And so I think I'm much more of a romantic than I am like a data geek when it comes to the football. I think of soccer as art and soccer players as artists. And Messi still manages to do things with some regularity that I've either never seen before or haven't seen done as well before. And just that to me speaks volumes.
Well, if I'm going to apply my Italian heritage to that, he would be Michelangelo and Da Vinci all at the same time. You know, just to equate that in terms of the artistry, it's just, you're right. When you watch Messi, you always watch him because there is something that can happen, that's something new, something creative. And this is a player that we've had eyeballs on for 15 to 20 years here now. And still today, you watch a match and you're like, what is he going to do today to mesmerize us? Because he'll always give you something different. It's amazing. And I always tell everybody the story about, for me, I mean, I've watched Lionel Messi on television 1,000 times, but I've seen him live twice, once in an Argentina uniform and once in a Barcelona uniform. And for me, the live version of Messi versus the television version of Messi, there is no comparison. It is like night and day. He is so much quicker, so much more intelligent with his speed, and that low center of gravity, man, it is something to watch. And if you ever get the chance to see Lionel Messi live, not, you know, being in the stadium, that is the best way to appreciate the genius and the skill that he has, because the television just doesn't do it enough justice for me.
So, listen, I can talk about Messi for the rest of the evening if you wanted to. But to that point, the first time I saw him play live in a meaningful game was under Jose Pekerman at the 2006 World Cup. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why he's able to prolong this sort of, you know, high point of performance is few players that I've seen know how to manage their energy within a game the way that Messi does. And I remember as a teenager at that World Cup in 2006, when he was on the same team as Riquelme, the amount of walking that he did, and I was flabbergasted, because at this point, like, yes, it's Lionel Messi, but also who is Lionel Messi at that point? And yet he's going out there and he's walking a significant amount of the time, but having that intelligence to know when the physicality is needed and when he should be sort of, in Spanish they say dosificado, but just managing that energy.
Amazing stuff. Yeah, let's definitely, because we could spend all night on Messi. I do want to ask you a prediction question before we leave La Liga. Obviously, we've got the tightest race. I think back to the Sergio Aguero goal for Manchester City in 2012, where it was decided at the last minute. The Premier League was decided on that day in that moment. Do you feel like the way these two teams are headed, Real Madrid and Barcelona, that we may end up with a Sergio Aguero moment at the end of the season where somebody scores a goal and wins the league?
I mean, I sure hope so. I think the most exciting Liga that I can remember in recent memory was 2014, and it wasn't Barcelona or Real Madrid winning it. It was Atletico, and it was because it was Atletico on the last day of the season at the Camp Nou against Barcelona, with those two teams playing in the virtual final. It was a draw, and Diego Godín's goal was that Aguero moment, right? Godín scores his header, and that gives Atleti the title over Barcelona on Barcelona's ground on the last day of the season. So, yeah, I mean, those are the moments that sports fans dream of, and it's so rare to get them in our sport just because of how the format sets out, that you can win the league as Bayern have done with rounds to spare, that it doesn't necessarily come down to that one final when it's in, you know, domestic league competition. So will we see that? I find it difficult to predict, especially under these circumstances, what the rest of the season is going to play out like. For example, in order for Real Madrid to win out, they'll have to win, you know, 11 straight La Liga games, the ones they've already won and the remaining games. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen that often. You have to go back to Zidane's first tenure, 2016. They went on like a 16-game winning streak, but that was over two different seasons, the end of one and the start of the other. Barcelona would have to win 8 in a row. They've done it more recently under Valverde in 2018, but that also doesn't happen all that often. And these two teams, I think this year, it hasn't been a season where you look at Real Madrid and Barcelona as like the favorites to win the Champions League, right? No one's looking at it like, those are definitely the two best teams this season. I think this season, you give Bayern Munich a shout, you give maybe Paris, even though they've been sort of on ice for some while, a shout as like potentially the deepest, most, you know, talented team. And so in a year where I think both Barcelona and Real Madrid have not been at the absolute brilliant best, I don't expect them to go on these long win streaks on short rest to win the season, especially when you factor in no fans in the stands, so that could hurt home field advantage. It's unlikely to me that we're going to see them win out. And so there's going to be some fluctuation. We might see one of these two teams pull away 4 or 5 points over the next few rounds. I just find it really highly unlikely that they both win out.
You know, it would be unfortunate magic if it did happen with no fans in the stands, unfortunately. That would be 2020. That would be very 2020 of the La Liga season for sure. Before I let you go, I do want to touch on Inter Miami, because obviously one of your new positions now with Inter Miami starting up their first season in MLS is the tournament coming up in Orlando starting on July 8th. I know we've only seen Inter Miami for a couple of matches, and they are going to be part of this tournament in Group A with Orlando City, New York City FC, Philadelphia Union, Chicago Fire, and Nashville FC. You know, other than NYCFC and maybe the Union, this looks like something, a manageable group that Inter could actually break into the top two. So I'd like your impressions, one, of Inter's chances in this tournament, and two, if you wouldn't mind touching on the possibility of this tournament being either postponed or canceled given this current situation in Florida with COVID-19.
Yeah, so I don't want to speculate on the second part of that, because it's neither my area of expertise nor anywhere where I have any like real basis to decide, you know, how those things can or cannot work, or whether, you know, the proper protocols would be effective or not. I don't work for the CDC, so it's just I'm better off just leaving that alone.
Right.
But the first part of that I'm happy to talk about, which one of those strange things is Inter Miami's group. But first of all, Inter Miami was one of my dream jobs before that club even existed. I was born in Havana, Cuba, but I've grown up in Miami. It's been a long, long time since the Miami Fusion, led by Ray Hudson, when they won the Supporters Shield, were contracted along with the Tampa Bay Rowdies from the league. And so for a long time, there wasn't, you know, top flight American soccer in Miami, and now there is, and I get to be a part of that. And that, to me, is just it's magical. It's an absolute dream, and it means the world to me, because I just love the city, and I've been fortunate over you know, again, a decade and a half now to call and work on some of the top, you know, football games on the planet, whether it was Serie A at beIN Sports and at Gold TV, Bundesliga at Gold TV, La Liga, the Ligue 1, the Copa Libertadores. And yet this, because it's my backyard, because it's my essentially hometown, just means a lot more to me than a lot of the other stuff has. That, you know, putting all of that, you know, aside, the weird thing about the group is it's the only group, all 26 teams in Orlando, and so it's the only group that has six teams instead of four, and yet Inter Miami will still only play three games. So I think it's a bit fortunate they don't have to play New York City, because there's two playoff teams from last season playoffs that are in that group. It's New York City FC and Philadelphia. They'll play Philadelphia. They won't play New York City FC in that group. Instead, I think they open up against Orlando in the inaugural game, which is like 15 days away at the time of recording. They'll play their second game against Philadelphia, and they'll close out against Chicago. I think two of those games are very winnable for Miami. I think some sort of extra consideration has been given to Orlando when people predict this group because they're playing at home. But again, what is home field advantage absent fans? And I'm just not sure that there is one necessarily. You could argue if it was another team that, you know, the Florida heat might play a factor. Well, it's hotter in Miami than it is in Orlando. It's more humid, so I'm not sure that that's going to be an issue either. And so I look at the Orlando and Chicago games as very winnable for Inter Miami, especially Chicago have a new coach. They're also a team in transition. We don't know exactly what they are. And Philadelphia, the middle game of those, as the most difficult one for Inter Miami because of the continuity. Their head coach has been there for a long, long time. It's a project that's been sort of nicely matured. And so Philadelphia will be, for Inter Miami, I think, the team to beat out of those three opponents. Beyond that, I think Inter Miami have been really competitive in their two games. They're probably very unlucky not to have picked up some points, probably plural, as opposed to just a point from those two first games against LAFC. I'll admit, LAFC in that inaugural match, they were the better team, but they needed an absolutely ridiculous Carlos Vela goal to beat Inter Miami 1-0 in their first ever MLS match. And after that, I thought, even when they were down a man, Inter Miami were the better side against DC United in DC. And so taking all of that into account, no one knows how these teams are going to come out of this break, but I've been impressed with how competitive Inter Miami have been in those first two games.
I couldn't agree with you more, especially, you know, the LAFC match you bring up, because LAFC was the better team, but like you said, there was a continuity of defense that Inter Miami offered in the match and just took their chances as they came. And they almost pulled it out. They almost pulled out a point. And thinking about opening your first match ever as a new club on the road against what many would have presumed to be the champion last year. I mean, obviously by fault of their own for not winning their matches, but you know, certainly the best team in MLS last season in LAFC. I thought it was an incredible showing for Inter Miami. And I agree with you. I think they could have easily pulled point or points from the first two matches. So I'm intrigued by them. I'm also intrigued by Nashville as well, just because they're the two new kids on the block. And to see how they perform, especially coming out of this huge break. Now the teams have had some time to kind of work together and gel together. And I think it will offer, you know, some more continuity for the teams and then be able to perform a little bit better. So, Drake, I want to thank you, you know, for joining us on the show. We have had an incredible time chatting with you. It has been too long. Definitely stay safe in Miami. All the best to you and enjoy the time covering Inter Miami and the La Liga race as we head to the finish.
It's been a pleasure, guys. I love the show. You guys talk, you know, real football. You get into the stuff that matters. So thanks again for the invite, and I'm happy to chat.
Thanks again. And special thanks again to Andres Cordero for coming on the show and giving us so much time as we got to talk about La Liga and MLS. Let's stick, Rob, with the La Liga theme right now and look at Spain at the moment. And again, at the time of this recording, we have a situation where Barcelona is ahead but behind, if you think about it. I'll give you the top the top of the table real quick. Barcelona 69 points after 32 matches. Real Madrid 68 points after 31 matches. Atleti, who moved all the way from 6th place, Rob, into 3rd, 58 points. Sevilla on 54 points. Then we have a little bit of a drop back to Getafe in the first Europa League spot at 49. Villarreal at 48. Real Sociedad at 47. Valencia 46, and Athletic Club at 45 points, which is it creates a massive, massive logjam there for those three Europa League spots. The bottom of the table, I think, Rob, at this point is
all but set. We have Espanyol at 24, coming up 25 on Leganes, 26 on Mallorca, and then we have 6 points up to Eibar. So I think that is, you know, that is a, I don't want to say it's a done situation, but it is pretty close to being done there, as Eibar have, not only do they have 6 points ahead of Mallorca, they also have a game at hand at 31 matches played so far. So let's focus back at the top of the table. Barca, at the time of this recording, draws 2-2 with Celta Vigo. A Celta Vigo team that, by the way, Rob, really came back from this break and has really performed well. Since they returned, they have, and I'm just looking quickly, they did lose to Villarreal 1-0, but then a 0-0 draw to Valladolid, coupled with a 6-0 win over Alaves, a 1-0 victory over Sociedad, and now a 2-2 draw with a late goal against Barcelona. Barcelona in first place by 1 point, but because of Real Madrid's game at hand, which is going to be, at the time of this recording, today against Mallorca, they're in big trouble here. And now that's the first slip we've truly seen in La Liga since we came back. We see Barca dropping points and Real Madrid ready to pounce. What do you think?
It really will be a tough one. I think this game that we saw between Barca and Celta, and even the one against Bilbao as well, that really is going to have a huge dent and a lot of repercussions on this entire title race in itself. I think we said this before, even when the restart happened, that it was going to come down to those type of games where you cannot lose points. Like, every point matters. Not even besides that, you know, you have your depth, you have the way that teams are rotating. That kind of thing is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think with Real Madrid, they've been able to do it properly because of the talent that they have and what they had at their disposal. Not saying they have much better talent than Barcelona, because they are definitely equal, but just the way that they're able to utilize it in certain games. Of course, there are a lot of controversy in terms of how VAR is being perceived for certain calls. I mean, we're not going to get into that. Right. I think what we really see is what the team has, what Zidane has at his disposal, and is able to use that properly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we're getting at right now. Of course, we don't know what could happen. We still have a few games left in the season, and it's far from over. We're not going to just say right here that the season's over and Real Madrid have won it. Thanks for playing. No. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still have games where, you know, Real Madrid could slip up. They could slip up. Not saying they will, but they can. So it will be tough to see. And like I said, I think it's going to be an exciting title race to the end.
I want to echo what you said, because Real Madrid, you know, they have a tough match coming up in midweek. We're going to talk about it in just a little bit. You know, so there's opportunities, and I'm looking at Real Madrid's schedule right now. Just quickly, you know, they have Athletic Club on the list still. They have Villarreal on the list still. They have a couple of, you know, tricky spots to manage. Now, granted, Athletic Club, they're going to be playing on the road, so that is, you know, that's going to be a spot to manage. I'm not going to give you the third match, because that's going to be in our match of the week. But yeah, there are spots here. But I think the key here, Rob, is Barca cannot afford to, they could not afford to drop points. And dropping those points late against Celta Vigo, I think, is extremely damaging. Because they were not in the, what we'd like to say, the catbird seat, where they were at the very top. They were tied at the top with Real Madrid, but because of the head-to-head, Real Madrid held the basically the gateway to the title. Barca could not afford to drop points, and getting that late goal from Iago Aspas in the match against Celta Vigo is just damaging. I mean, if you want to take a bright point out of the match against Celta Vigo, it was that Luis Suarez scored 2 goals. I think that is something to be celebrated. I think unfortunately Lionel Messi is still stuck on 699, and I think he's looking to break that, and I think he's starting to press a little bit. But they can't lose sight of the difficult path that Real Madrid have in the next couple of matches, because there is going to possibly be an opportunity to get those points back. But from here on out, Barca have to be perfect, don't you think, Rob?
Yeah, they definitely do. Yeah. I think that's what's expected of them, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to that end, Real don't need to be as perfect. They can drop points. They can pick up a draw against Athletic Club on the road. That can happen, and they'll still be in position to win this league. So, you know, by all means, you and I are definitely not calling this league over. There's no way we can call this league over, but it took a giant step forward over the weekend in terms of Real Madrid
possibly picking up that title, possibly, you know, earning La Liga for the 2019-2020 season. Let's move from there and let's go over to Italy because, you know, we have a situation developing in Italy as well. And, you know, when we first talked about Italy coming back, we talked about the beginnings of this, you know, restart. And we talked about, I believe, with Matt Santangelo, where we said Lazio had a tough run. They had Atalanta, they had Fiorentina for the first two matches to come in. They're going to come in cold. And it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate those two matches that will kind of give you the title or give you the indication, because Juve were going to get a couple of matches under their feet with the Coppa Italia. So we fast forward now to today. Juve lead by 4 points. Lazio midweek dropped the match to Atalanta. They were up 2-0, and Atalanta did what I term to you, Rob, is Atalanta things. They score goals for fun. And they pull out a 3-2 victory. They try, you know, Atalanta's also in a position to try and maintain that last Champions League spot as well. They are currently 6 points ahead of Roma on the table. And they need those matches as badly as Lazio needed it. And Juve managed to come back from the break, and they managed to beat Bologna 2-0. They took Lecce 4-0, which was a little tighter than the 4-0 score actually gave you, and it really wasn't until Lecce went down to 10 men that Juve were kind of able to exact their will on them. We're not still seeing the Cristiano Ronaldo we expect out of them, but it's something that is coming along, and thank God for Paulo Dybala, because he's been an absolute star the past few times. They've had injury issues. They had Danilo out. They had Decilio out, and it was Blaise Matuidi playing right back over the weekend, so that was a rather interesting thing. He had done it once before. Lazio, on the other hand, did bounce back. They were down 1-0 to Fiorentina and then managed to pull out a 2-1 victory in that match. So now Lazio currently sit 4 points behind. We still have 10 matches to play in Italy. Inter, I would say for all intents and purposes are out of it, but Inter, with their match coming up on the weekend, could pull to within 7 points, I'm sorry, 8 points of Juventus. So it's still a long ways to go, so I don't think we can call this one over, but certainly Juventus are in the driver's seat, and especially if Juve can take 3 points out of their match against Lazio or Atalanta, I think we could call this match or this league over and done. But Juve have a very, very difficult path. They have Lazio, they have Atalanta, they have AC Milan coming up. There's some tough spots there for them, and it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. Rob, what are your thoughts on the top of the table? Let me ask you first. Is Inter in this race still, or would we say it's a two-horse race now?
No, Inter not in this race.
Got it.
So absolutely not. It's still Lazio. And to be fair, man, I told you, and I'm going to say this, I think this league is done. I'm going to say, I don't know. This Juventus side, yes, while it did screw up a little bit in their game, not screw up, but didn't play as perfectly planned against Milan and Napoli, they're trying to find form. They're starting to find form. They're starting to get back to things. And like I said, just like what we're seeing in La Liga, and we're seeing it across all the top leagues in the world, it's going to be for that depth and how useful that Sarri, in this case, can do it. Yeah. I don't see Juventus screwing up in this one. I'd love to be wrong. I would love to see a title race. Absolutely. I'd love to see Lazio try to battle it out to the end. And, you know, if Atalanta could surprise more people, we'd go for it. Mm-hmm. I just, on a realistic standpoint, I think this league is finished.
Genoa, Torino, AC Milan, Atalanta, Sassuolo, Lazio. Those are the next six matches that Juve have on their schedule. Genoa, Torino, AC Milan, Atalanta, Sassuolo, and Lazio. They close the season against Cagliari, who had a pretty good showing on the weekend, and Roma. So this is why, I mean, you know, I'm a Juventino. I want to think that they're going to go perfect and they're just going to win all their matches. But, man, this is a tough spot in the schedule for them, you know, going forward. You know, just like we said, Lazio, we're going to have a tough time returning. This is where Juve's tough time is going to be. Looking at Lazio's run here, and I'm just pulling up the information quickly, we have them, you know, showing up against Torino on the weekend, then they're going to have AC Milan. Then they also get Sassuolo. And the reason I point out Sassuolo is because they're actually playing very, very well right now. They managed to, all intents and purposes, end Inter's title hopes, right? Obviously, they're going to have Juve. They're going to have Cagliari. They're going to have Napoli to close the season. So you know, Lazio have a tough road ahead of them as well. It's going to be interesting to see how that happens and how that pans out, especially with the matches being so tight. Going to the bottom of the table, Rob, two of the relegation spots for me are already decided, Brescia and Spal, and it makes me wonder when that Sandro Tonali to Inter transfer is going to finally be announced, because Brescia are pretty much done. They might as well have the fire sale and get rid of the pieces they need to. But Lecce are still in this. They're only 1 point behind Genoa and Sampdoria, and they're 3 points behind Udinese. So there is a massive title race. But Lecce are currently losers of four straight matches dating back to pre-stoppage. And they're going to have to get their ball rolling here. And granted, they had a tough time against Juve, but they did make a nice showing of it before they went down to 10 men. This is going to be a run worth watching. Genoa on the weekend tying they tied Brescia, which again is an opportunity lost at that point, given that that Brescia is the bottom dwellers. But it's going to be interesting to see, because it seems like none of the teams at the bottom want to step up and grab those spots and save themselves. So interesting to see as we move along in the season. So we do have one more piece of information that we want to talk about. You know, we opened with transfers, right? And there is a brewing or developing story coming out of Paraguay, my friend, that, of course, you broke again. And, you know, so without further ado, I would like you to tell us what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So the big news that is coming out of Paraguay is that Atlanta United is set to sign 18-year-old forward Eric Lopez from Olimpia. You know, this isn't obviously just my report. This is from numerous reports coming from various different journalists and, you know, different sources in the country. You know, this, I think, is a transfer that I feel is going to happen, because I feel like when all of these kind of reports are coming into place, and, you know, obviously I'm speaking to sources as well, close to the player, to the club, And I think this is a really good move for him. You know, he's an 18-year-old forward. He actually just made his debut last year at the age of 17, scoring in his debut against Deportivo Santander. He has, I think he's played like 16 times for Olimpia, 4 goals, 2 assists. You know, the first player born in the 21st century to score in 3 consecutive games in the Paraguayan league. So just a bit of the characteristics that he has. You know, he's not really a natural striker as you would point him. He's more of a second forward, so he could obviously shift around the attack if he needs to. You know, he has good speed, vision, good one-on-one ability, you know, the strength to beat his man. And it always seems like he always has the ball with him. So, you know, it's not a Miggy 2.0, but it really is a player that, you know, obviously has a good blue chip on his shoulder. So he really is a good talent. I think, you know, as you said, Joe, I think this is some of the moves that MLS needs. I think it's another, you know, check mark for Atlanta United, if this, of course, happens, that, you know, they're looking into this kind of business of young South American talents and helping them succeed. You know, we saw that with Almirón. We saw that with Ezequiel Barco. We saw it with Titi Martinez. Joseph Martinez as well, even though he's not as young, but, you know, Tito Villalba as well. You know, they're looking into that kind of region, well, not region, but of at least of South American, young South American players. Mm-hmm. And it's been working great. So this obviously is another good step for the league and for the team. And hopefully it does come about. I mean, we need more of this young talent in the league to help boost it up. And, you know, if Atlanta are starting to think of a world without Joseph Martinez, I mean, obviously that will probably happen because he's still injured, but here's your guy right here.
Yeah, you know, and you hit the nail on the head. This is a league. This is a move that I like for the league, because I think this is where MLS needs to be at the moment in terms of the global picture. A developing league, a young league. I'd love to, you know, to say that they would be on par with a league like Portugal or the Dutch league. This is not, you know, degrading MLS. This is actually praising them. If you can develop talent like you could in the Netherlands, or you could develop talent like they do in Portugal, my God, I mean, that is a phenomenal place to be in. And this is the kind of move that you need to make as a league or as teams in a league that will put you on that path to be that type of upper echelon developmental league. And a kid like Eric Lopez comes in at 18 years old, spends a couple of years at Atlanta United, moves on to England or Spain. I mean, sounds a lot like Miggy 2.0 in that regard. And And I think, and it's funny that it happened at Atlanta United, just like the last one happened at Atlanta United. I know that we are efforting some higher level people down in Paraguay that can possibly come on and talk about this. We'll see if we can nail somebody down and get them on our next show. I think that would be a great thing. Again, Rob, like you said, this has not been made official as of yet, but it is certainly coming out of multiple sources in Paraguay, and you are the first American journalist to report this. So I think, you know, bravo to you. And and I think you know, as this goes on and as this happens, I think maybe Carlos Bocanegra should have your cell phone number.
Just follow me on Twitter. I realize you just follow me on Twitter.
So there you go. So, you know, maybe Carlos should be looking to you instead of some of these other folks. And when he needs this type of South American contact, that you're the guy that, you know, he'll figure that out. So, but again, we'll hopefully get to effort somebody that might come on and discuss this, somebody higher level. Again, you know, somebody that we had on recently is a product of this particular youth academy, Marco Trovato, who is the president of Olympia. So it is a great opportunity for MLS. It's a great opportunity for some younger South American players, some talents that maybe instead of going to Portugal or going to the Netherlands or, you know, or some of those, even Turkey or Greece, that they can come here and we can build this MLS league with that in mind. So. Rob, let's table that and let's go to our matches of the week coming up. Well, again, we've got a pretty full slate for the week again. You know, right now, Rob and I are saying we can give you guys Wednesday and Friday off for the most part. So enjoy it. Although there are matches on those days. I'm going to open with on Tuesday coming up, Torino-Lazio, 1:30 p.m. That's a big one. And Genoa-Juve at 3:45 p.m. And if that wasn't big enough for you, the biggest match of the week, I think, Barca-Atletico. 4 p.m. Again, this is another spot where maybe when we come on in the next show, we'll look at the result of this Barca-Atleti matchup and say, yep, that finally decided La Liga for the 2019-2020 season. On Thursday, we have Atalanta-Napoli at 1:30 p.m. That promises to have, what, Rob, 6-7 goals in it? Something along probably those lines. Yeah, it's going to be some crazy number. But if there's not enough goals in that one, you could tune in at 3:15 to watch Manchester City Liverpool as Liverpool step onto the pitch for the first time as champions of England. And if that's not good enough for you, the first banana skin in Real Madrid's path to the championship and to the La Liga title is Getafe at 4 p.m. on Thursday. Saturday, you can wake up with Norwich, Brighton, and Hove Albion, which is a relegation battle coming up at 7:30 a.m. Then we have the Derby della Mole, Juve-Torino at 11:15 a.m., and then Lazio-AC Milan at 3:45 p.m. On Sunday, we have Napoli-Roma, another great matchup to watch at 3:45 p.m., and Villarreal-Barcelona at 4 p.m., another tricky spot for Barca in their champ in their title hopes. On Monday, when we because we're off next week, Tottenham Hotspur-Everton will come on at 3 p.m. So that'll be something to replace our show as well. Rob, with that run of games coming up, let me give you the trivia question again, my friend. And it goes back to our opening thoughts topic of the transfer between Arthur Melo and Miralem Pjanic, swapping teams with an extra $10 million going to Barca from Juve on this one. Pjanic is 30, Arthur 23 years old. Arthur has played for two teams. Pjanic has played for four. Can you give me the six teams that they have played for collectively? And obviously two of them you already have as Juve and Barca. So can you give me four more teams?
All right. So the first one off the top of my head is obviously Arthur's first professional club. That's Gremio.
That's correct. He came over to Barca from Gremio just a couple years ago. And that would tally up Arthur's all of Arthur's teams. Who are the three teams we're looking for Miralem Pjanic?
I think, well, obviously the club that Pjanic played for before he went to Juventus is Roma. That's mm-hmm. another one.
That's right.
I think he played in France.
That's right.
He played in France. One of the clubs. What's that? Sorry.
I was going to give you a hint. It was only in France. So it's two teams in France.
Okay. So I know one. Mm-hmm. Is it Metz?
Metz is where he started his career.
No, he went to one more club before that. After that.
That's correct.
So I'm going to guess it was Lyon.
It is Lyon. The six teams we're looking for. Miralem Pjanic has played for Metz, Lyon, Roma, and Juve. And Arthur has played for Gremio and Barca. And now Pjanic and Arthur will swap places and add another team to each list. So, and actually, not only another team, Rob, but another country. So
that's right.
Pretty interesting for both. So that is some good stuff, my friend. And without anything left on the docket, let's hit the closing music.
Let's do it.
All right. so for episode 288 of Low Limit Football. Special thanks again to Andres Cordero for joining us. Next week, we are off for the 4th of July holiday here in the United States, but we'll be returning the following week. At the moment, we have David Amoyal scheduled to join us, as well as possibly a second guest to discuss the Eric Lopez transfer as well. So, for episode 288 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night.